Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSEA 106.1 LPFM on January 8th, 2005. I'm Amy Antonucci, and I'm going to let you know what's coming up these next 2 hours. We are coming up on or just passing a number of very important anniversaries in the fight against nuclear weapons and power in the world. In honor of those, we are going to be focusing on nuclear issues today. We will go back to 1979 in an audio report from an action at Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, our neighbor. We'll hear information about depleted uranium weaponry and an interview with local resident Guy Chichester, who is an active participant in the struggle to keep Seabrook Station from going online. First, let's start with the news. Speaking of nuclear issues, from the Kyoto News, the U.S. seeks to defang non-proliferation treaty. The United States plans to suggest that a 2005 international conference to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty should invalidate a document adopted at a 2000 meeting in which 5 nuclear powers committed to an unequivocal undertaking to a nuclear-free world, according to U.S. government and congressional sources. Such an attempt could be interpreted by non-nuclear powers as reduced commitment by the U.S. to nuclear disarmament and could jeopardize the non-proliferation regime under the 1968 treaty by possibly prompting countries, such as North Korea and Iran, to accelerate their nuclear weapons development, critics say. In the 2000 review conference, 187 signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty adopted the document, which includes 13 steps to nuclear disarmament to be implemented by the 5 powers, which are the U.S., Britain, China, Russia, and France, as well as non-nuclear powers. Thomas Graham, former Special Representative of the U.S. President for Arms Control, Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, said he believes the U.S. delegation at the review conference would be under very firm instructions not to agree to the point of unequivocal undertaking to total elimination of nuclear weapons. If the U.S. is not going to observe its commitment, then the treaty becomes politically unbalanced, said Graham, who served under all U.S. administrations from President Jimmy Carter to Bill Clinton. He expressed concern about possible nuclear proliferation, saying non-nuclear powers could start developing nuclear weapons. They could follow in the footsteps of India and Pakistan, non-parties to the treaty that conducted nuclear tests in 1998, Graham said. Education Department paid journalist. The AP reported that the Bush administration paid a prominent journalist to promote President Bush's education law and give Education Secretary Rod Paige media time, records show. Armstrong Williams, a nationally syndicated radio, print, and television personality, was paid $240,000 by the Education Department to promote the No Child Left Behind Act. The contract required Williams' company, the Graham Williams Group, to produce radio and TV ads that promote the controversial law and feature one-minute reads by Page. The deal also allowed Page and other department officials to appear as studio guests with Williams. Williams, one of the leading black conservative voices in the country, was also to use his influence with other black journalists to get them to talk about No Child Left Behind. The law, the centerpiece of President Bush's domestic agenda, aims to raise achievement among poor and minority children with penalties for many schools that don't make progress. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said Friday that the practice of using Williams to promote the law has been stopped, which he called the appropriate decision. The department's contract with Williams, through the public relations firm Ketchum, dates to 2003 and 2004. It is billed as a minority outreach campaign with the goal of educating the African-American community about the education law. from the American Progress Action Fund website. Economy, Fiscal Self-Misunderestimation. The White House has hashed a host of cosmetic changes and misleading exemptions to give the nation's fiscal outlook a phony facelift when the five-year budget plan is presented in February. First, to help President Bush fulfill his campaign promise to cut the deficit in half by 2009, administration officials have decided to measure their progress against a $521 billion deficit they predicted last February, rather than last year's actual shortfall of $413 billion, the New York Times reports. That way, Mr. Bush can say he has already reduced the shortfall by about $100 billion and claim victory if the deficit falls to just $260 billion, again, the New York Times reported. In addition, administration officials are invoking optimistic assumptions about rising tax revenue while excluding costs for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as trillions of dollars in costs that lie just outside Mr. Bush's five-year budget window. Also left out of the budget plan is the president's Social Security privatization plan, which experts say may cost as much as $2 trillion. Once again, the battle looms over drilling in the Alaska Wildlife Refuge. With Republicans having added 4 seats to increase their Senate majority to 55, the battle over drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is high on the agenda once again. Rather than including ANWR as part of an energy bill, pro-drilling forces are expected to attempt to insert ANWR into a budget resolution. This is because an energy bill can be filibustered, with 60 votes required to end the filibuster, while a budget resolution requires only a simple majority and cannot be filibustered. The GOP sought to use this tactic in 2003, but lost by a 52-48 vote. Senator Gregg, our senator here, supports drilling in ANWR, and the New Hampshire Global Warming Campaign, a project of the National Environmental Trust, is going to be working to get him to change his mind. Please call Jan Pendlebury at 603-224-1955 if you would like to get involved.
This is Steve Diamond with news from Iraq. This first story, as broadcast on CNN and the BBC, U.S. Army Reserve, a broken force. The commander of the U.S. Army Reserve says it is rapidly degenerating into a broken force. Lieutenant General James Helmley, in a leaked memo to the Pentagon, says the reserve has reached a point where it cannot fulfill its missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Reservists provide a large share of U.S. troops in Iraq. The internal memorandum was first reported in the Baltimore Sun and appeared on the internet later. In it, General Helmley says that under current procedures, his force will be unable to meet mission requirements associated with Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan under current policies. General Helmley takes issue with a number of Pentagon practices he calls dysfunctional, including, among others, financial incentives to attract and retain reservists on active duty, which the general says confuses volunteers with mercenaries, and reservists being called to active duty at only a few days' notice. The BBC's Nick Childs in Washington says such blunt words from a senior general are likely to provide further ammunition for critics who argue that the current policies are doing long-term harm to America's all-volunteer military. U.S. Army forces have been placed under considerable strain by the wars launched by President George W. Bush during his first term. Some commentators have accused Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld of not accepting that huge troop deployments were needed, notably in Iraq. The next story was reported earlier this week in the Times Online of Britain. Iraq's rapidly swelling insurgency numbers 200,000 fighters and active supporters and outnumbers the United States-led coalition forces, the head of the country's intelligence service said yesterday. The number is far higher than the U.S. military has so far admitted and paints a much grimmer picture of the challenge facing the Iraqi authorities and their British and American backers as elections loom. I think the resistance is bigger than the U.S. military in Iraq. I think the resistance is more than 200,000 people, said General Muhammad Abdullah Shawani, director of Iraq's new intelligence services. Ongoing bomb attacks continue to kill members of the Iraqi security forces, and the head of the Baghdad division of the Iraqi National Guard admitted that his paramilitary police force had been infiltrated by people who are leaking information to the guerrillas. General Shawani said that there were at least 40,000 hardcore fighters attacking U.S. and Iraqi troops, with the bulk made up of part-time guerrillas and volunteers providing logistical support, information, shelter, and money. "People are fed up after 2 years without improvement," he said. "People are fed up with no security, no electricity. People feel they have to do something." The army, dissolved by the American Occupation Authority, was hundreds of thousands of people. You'd expect some veterans would join with their relatives. Each one has sons and brothers. With elections less than a month away, the guerrillas have launched a massive campaign of attacks against anyone linked with the coalition or the Iraqi authorities.
You're listening to Making Waves on WSCA 106.1 LPFM. As mentioned earlier, this is a time of anniversaries marking progress in eliminating nuclear weapons. January 7, 1996, there were meetings of the Commission on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons held in Australia. Further back, on January 11, 1952, both the UN Disarmament Commission was set up and the first British nonviolent protest against nuclear weapons was held, where 10 people had a sit-in on the War Office steps. Meanwhile, here we all sit, down the road from Seabrook Station in Seabrook, New Hampshire, the nuclear power plant made famous by the nonviolent resistance movement against its creation back in the 1970s. Although one of the two planned Seabrook reactors did come online, the hundreds of expected plants over the country did not go forward, a victory for anti-nuclear protesters. However, here in the seacoast, we do have a nuclear neighbor, as many of us are reminded of when we get our evacuation plan handbooks every year. Nuclear waste generated at the plant today will be harmless in 250,020 years. We're now going to hear a song by Steve Brennan, Shadow of the Dome. And then we're going to hear coverage from a protest at Seabrook in 1979.
Well, I watched them build it all these years. It rose into the sky by the shore a few miles from my home. It's a monument to greed, and what $6 billion will buy. I'm living in the shadow of the dome. I hear them on my radio, I see them on TV. They got the power for the many things I own. And they tell me not to worry, everything is A-okay. Here within the shadow of the dome, I love to tend my garden. Lord, I am a simple man, and I love to watch in wonder as it grows. But now a doubtful shadow's cast upon the fertile land. Could it be the shadow of a dome? Ballot box was sacred in my eyes. They've taken power majority is hostage to their profits and their lies. And now I am a refugee in search of higher ground. I cannot live in fear of my own home. And the wailing of that siren makes a most ungodly sound as it echoes through the shadow of the door. It echoes through the shadow.
In 1976, the Clamshell Alliance, opposing construction of a nuclear power plant in the small seacoast town, revived the strategy of the civil rights and anti-war movements, nonviolent civil disobedience, which spread across the country and became a major tactic in the opposition to nuclear power. The following year, over 1,400 people climbed over the fence around the Seabrook construction site, resulting in the largest mass arrest at a nuclear site in American history. This past October, Seabrook was again the scene of a new development in the struggle against nuclear power. Not symbolic, but direct action, an attempt to actually occupy the site of the now almost completed reactor and stop construction rather than making a purely moral point. The Direct Action Coalition maintained its commitment to nonviolent principles, but those on both sides of the developing confrontation were jittery on the night of Friday, October 5th, as demonstrators once again poured into Seabrook.
In 1977, demonstrators came from New England. In 1979, they came from all over the country, some traveling to Seabrook from Texas and California. Many things about October 6th were new. For example, a willingness to put up with the violence of the state if the reward meant actually shutting down a nuclear power plant. This year, things were different. In the wake of Three Mile Island, a direct action task force was formed within New England's Clamshell Alliance. It recommended that Clamshell directly occupy the Seabrook nuke in 1979. A Clamshell Congress unanimously endorsed the action and directed the task force to call it. From this task force was organized the Coalition for Direct Action at Seabrook, which grew to include more than 75 anti-nuclear groups from New England, New York, and the rest of the country. The residents of Seabrooks have been fighting the nuke for a decade. Those 10 years have educated and mobilized people against nuclear power. But it has not succeeded in halting construction of the plant, nor given the anti-nuclear movement the confidence that people can shut down nukes themselves, and, learning from this, a way to respond to situations in everyday life. The coalition, despite high risks, therefore undertook to organize a direct action occupation that would bring a community on the nuke site and block construction permanently. A call to action was sent out. Nonviolence training and tactical preparation sessions were held for occupiers. Almost 100 people were involved in arranging publicity, writing an occupation handbook, organizing participants into affinity groups, which is a group of friends who gather together because they have a common political theory and wish to achieve a particular goal.
Edgar Batome of the Direct Action Coalition describes the scene on Friday, October 5th.
Local police have been very visible and have been done no unreasonable harassment. The Attorney General's office, which is doing the PR and the press release, has done everything they can to intimidate people from coming on site, including today's Boston Herald, which informs us that all the state police carry Magnum pistols, that they're going to be 60 attack dogs. Rumor is very strong up here and fairly well confirmed that there's a light army tank, don't ask me why, on site. Also that all the fire departments and their hoses are on site. So the attempt to terrorize people out of the action by what power they're going to have there, the National Guard, state police, out-of-state police, has been enormous.
Members of the coalition spoke with workers at the plant.
What do I think of what's going on here? I think it's a bunch of communists behind it. And I think all these bunch of people are following the wrong leaders. And I mean Jane Fonda and Dr. Spock and all the rest of the bunch of hippies.
Would you describe yourself as anti-nuke or pro-nuke?
I don't like them at all. I wish there was another way. But there's a lot of people that need jobs around here, you know. really hard to say. It's really hard to say because I don't think as me working in this plant is going to benefit anybody but myself. You know? And it's kind of hard to work in conditions like that. Because nobody, it doesn't seem to me like anybody knows what's actually going on in the construction part of it. Maybe because I'm just a regular worker, but I'm not sure, you know.
You don't think there's much care being put into building this plant?
I don't think there's much foresight in the use of nuclear power plants anyways. I think they should come up with something else. What else you got? What else do you have, you know? I could go work in a shoe factory. I could pick apples. They're in season now. You know? But they won't pay me $10 an hour either.
And the people in the plant will.
That's right.
Most of those who arrived the previous night were already making their way through woods and marshes towards the plant site by the time dawn broke on Saturday. Edgar Bertome describes the internal structure of the affinity groups.
What we've got is a large number of affinity groups, each affinity group divided into two subgroups. One is a group of occupiers and one is a group of support. Each affinity group of occupiers will have its own means of getting through the fence. Over the fence, under the fence, through the fence. That's their decision. They'll make that. The support group is a backup to make sure that they're well fed, housed, clothed. You know, it rains tonight and they get soaking wet. They got to get them dry. They got to get them a hot breakfast tomorrow morning, whatever they can do. And so these decisions will be made one by one by each affinity group. And each affinity group acts more or less independently on its own, except for general guidelines we've laid out on timing and targets, both as far as spots on the fence and as far as the priorities listed in the handbook go. So that there's a very different, it's not, you know, you are cutting the wire, it's your, this affinity group, section red of the fence is yours and go.
The demonstrators took three routes. The largest group from Boston advanced towards the plant's south gate. Affinity groups from other New England states moved across marshes towards the northeast gate. We joined a contingent from New York and Connecticut and walked through the brisk sunny morning along railroad tracks to the northwest entrance to the plant.
The route that we're taking here has been impassable because of the heavy rains last night, and the scouting party went up to check it out, and the spokes are meeting now to hear a report on whether or not it's going to be passable or not. If it's not passable, we're going to develop another plan, and we're just going to keep at it.
Through consensus?
Yes, though there is a majority rule, 75%, when we cannot reach consensus. But so far, I've been watching consensus work.
The proposal was that affinity groups go by the way that they want to go, by the railroad tracks or around by the road. They were in two ways. We could not reach consensus.
Is there any contact at all with people at the other gates?
There's been minor contact, I think, but not extensive enough. Hopefully we'll be able to get more communication once we get up here.
Let's do it!
They already brought a busload in. They have tear gas and water hoses waiting for us. And it was just insane. It was really stupid that we had the meeting there because we were vulnerable from every side.
We walked up to the gate. At that point, there was just one fellow there with a flashlight. And he didn't say anything. I mean, we tried talking with him. At first, he didn't want to talk to us. When we began snipping the fences, he got on his radio, and a few minutes later, the man arrived.
Was he a cop, or was he just a worker?
No, a construction worker, foreman or something.
So do you think you had time to come inside if you wanted to before the police arrived?
Oh, very definitely. We could have had 1,000 or 2,000 people inside.
Why didn't anybody go in?
I don't know. They wanted to hold another meeting.
It would have been a trap. It would have served no purpose. Certainly, there was more. There, at the point, by the time we were finished cutting fences, there were, say, a dozen police watching us. waiting probably for more reinforcements. They did bring up reinforcements, better equipped, and so forth. But to cut a few holes in the fence and try to run through would have simply meant the tactic of allowing ourselves to get arrested, which I am not into. I'm into keeping the harassment up. As long as I'm on the outside, then they've got to worry about me.
What do you think it is at this point in terms of how the occupiers stand versus the police right now?
Well, it's a stalemate. They're not doing any construction here, which is our main objective anyway, to shut them down economically. They can only hold out for so long without maintaining construction here, and then the system goes bankrupt. That's our prime objective here anyway, is to shut it down however we can. Economically seems to be the most viable thing at this point. I hope it doesn't turn into a bloodbath.
We concentrated our affinity groups along the seawall area on the southern marsh. With the marsh in back of us, we approached the fence. In back of the fence were massed dozens of state police. Around 10 a.m. we went in. At first, many of us approached the fence and were maced several times. We retreated and returned carrying large sheets of plastic to hold up as a shield while others from the affinity groups cut the fence. The shield worked so well that the police decided that it was time for more effective tactics and threw out tear gas. When the tear gas drifted back at them, the police decided to come out of the planned perimeter and attack demonstrators on the northern marsh.
The police were on the other side of the fence, and some attempts were made to cut the fence, and they were successful to a minor extent. And they started repairing the fence, and then the police made a decision to go on the people's side of the fence, so they couldn't even get near the fence to cause any damage.
I talked to people who were maced, and they said that some of the police who maced them were laughing as they did it.
You saw people being maced?
Oh, yeah. Anyone who came near the fence, it was at least about 25, 30 people, I'm sure, got it pretty directly. And then the cops came on the marsh side of the fence where all the people were and ransacked any pack they could looking for gas masks, ripping them off people's faces and knocking them down and hurting them about.
The police eventually brought up a fire hose and sprayed us with high-pressure streams of water mixed with irritating chemicals. Well, the hoses were supposed to have been high pressure. They leaked. But as was repeated several times during the next several days, we got drenched. People did some fence cutting even while being sprayed with water, but each time a fence was cut, we would hesitate before going in, and the police would come charging out.
At that time, the people just move even further into the marsh with the tide come in, have just gone into groups and trying to avoid the police as much as possible. But the police are very close to them, not on the Seabrook side of the fence. And last time I saw them, about 11 o'clock, they were just in big groups, not sure what to do.
How many people do you think?
I'd say probably about 1,000 people.
And is there any effort being made to link up that group of people with the people on the north side or the other?
Not that I saw, no.
Mm-mm. We were there, setting up a diversionary tactic. So the people on the south side were going to try to keep the cops busy while the north side went through. But
communication seemed difficult.
Yeah, so no one knows if it's going to work or not. They're chasing people around after mass and throwing them to each other. It was incredible.
It was like a big circus.
While people were resting on the marsh, police came once again to try to confiscate even more gas masks. A confrontation happened, and an affinity group linked arms to prevent further police incursions. Other affinity groups joined with linked arms, and soon a human chain of more than 1,000 people was snaking its way all around the plant, forcing the police back near the fence. While police looked on in bewilderment, people sang, chanted, raising their arms in solidarity, turning a tense atmosphere into a festival. People, not some artificial system of spokespeople, talked with National Guardsmen, who proved to be much more human and willing to talk than did the state police, who were unfavorably compared with cigar store Indians. Still, there are obvious differences between those protecting the plant and those seeking to occupy it.
It's very clear that they don't want to arrest anyone. They'd much rather just, you know, deal with the demonstrators, you know, with mace and clubs, and try to discourage them that way, because they can't deal with 2,000 people in the legal system.
What are people going to do now? People who are in the swamps with the tide coming in, is there any way they can move around?
Yeah.
I left at 11 o'clock, and people were very unsure what to do at that point, and there was no unity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It seemed like there might have been some signs of success until the police utilized that strategy. go outside the actual grounds of the plant and start chasing people, macing people.
Right. Anyone who came near got maced. Anyone who had gas masks was ripped off their face.
I think they realize that the only way to get in is to everyone get together and go together, and they don't want to do that because they know people will get hurt, and they're really trying very hard to prevent any injuries.
After meeting all night at their staging area on the property of Tony Santasucci, next to the construction site, the 3,000 or so demonstrators finally agreed to make a unified assault on the plant's south gate. They temporarily divided into three groups and moved into the woods to confuse police observing them from the ever-present helicopters. Then, all three groups swarmed out of the woods and rapidly moved towards the gate.
The plant will not be built!
The plant will not be built!
With nonviolence!
The plant will not be built!
With nonviolence!
The plant will not be built!
The fence, they're cutting the fence. They're cutting the fences. It's a massive crowd, a massive scene. Banners are waving. People are staring up in the sky at the helicopter, hovering over the gates of the plant. Cops are outside the gate waving their clubs.
I don't care what you are. Back off. Back up. Back up.
They're spraying gas. They're spraying gas. People are linking arms.
No exit. Hard rain.
Cops are forcing people back!
Please! 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 We come to you! We come to you! We come to you! Please!
A line of policemen with gas masks and clubs are confronting demonstrators sitting down on the site, at the entrance to the site. They're beating someone. About, must be three or four cops are sitting on top of somebody. They're kneeing him in the neck, waving their clubs. Cop just removed a woman's gas mask, just ripped it off of her face as she was trying to protect her eyes against the gas. People are dispensing water, trying to protect people's eyes from the gas.
Were you up at the fence?
Yes.
What happened?
We had two ropes on the fence, pulled it back. We opened the fence and they came running out at us, macing us, gassing, hitting little girls with clubs. It was ridiculous. We were running back, man. You know, and they were still macing us, ripping off our masks and macing us. Saw one guy go for a guy's mask almost right when we were about to leave. He ripped the guy's mask off, sprayed him. Matter of fact, he sprayed my friend 15 inches from his mouth, right in his mouth. He said, "Don't, listen, I'm going." Boom. That's it.
I saw them poking people with their clubs.
Oh, God, right through the fence, man. Boom, boom. And then when they were out, you know, they followed us all the way to the end. They were hitting people, chasing them off things, you know, and hitting people just who were walking away. Even little kids, man, I couldn't believe it.
No news! No news! No news! No news! No news! No news!
This was what the police had been instructed to do. This is what they were willing to do to us to protect the nuclear power plant.
I got thrown into a tree. I got my mask pulled off my face and mace sprayed directly point blank into my eyes. You know, I live in New England. I pay taxes in New England. I served in the service. I was air controller in Vietnam. I'm an American and this is my country.
The whole world is watching. 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 The whole world is watching.
We can't sit back. They're bringing in dogs.
Yet, even after these experiences, the affinity groups from the coalition doggedly hung on. Individual affinity groups took off from the main group and headed into the woods. We ran across the marshes and tried to do small harassment and fence-cutting actions. One man was caught by the police and mercilessly beaten on the northern marsh.
There was an old man about 85 years old who was the last person left when the cops began pushing people, and he was sitting there. They kept avoiding him until the end, and they finally got him. They grabbed his mask off, sprayed mace in his face until he was dripping with mace, and said, "See how much of that you can take, old man," and kept pushing him and kicking him. I helped him all the way back to the medic tent back here.
I think what it's shown is that they're willing to defend these things almost at all costs of human safety, and we came here with the intent of being nonviolent. We have shown that. The authority have shown that they can be very violent, and that they, it seems that the problems that they've given Tony Santasucci on his land show that they hold private property of the conglomerates more sacred than private property of the individuals and the private property of the people here in Seabrook. And so their issue that, you know, this is private property, well, they're not respecting private property either. So I think it's a real bogus issue that they raise on that part. And when that starts getting home to what you might call the people in Wisconsin, I think they're going to start being very affected about it, and they're going to start demanding that the nuclear power plants be closed.
Don't want no nuclear power plant.
That was from the Coalition for Direct Action at Seabrook, recorded in 1979 during their action at Seabrook Station.
Just like us, and we keep wanting more.
what we have to do. Say it doesn't matter if the aquifer falls down 10 feet a year, as that still leaves 30 more till the final year before it is bone dry, bone dry, bone dry. But they tell you don't worry, got to hurry, 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 got to suck it up, drill it up now. And there are wise men in white lab coats gonna fix it back up somehow. They say it doesn't matter if the factory smoke stack fouls up this town's air. If it's foresight that we lack, all we can build a taller stack. Send it to the next town, every which way round. But they tell you don't worry, got to hurry, hurry, hurry. There's a quick buck, money, money now. And there are wise men in white lab coats gonna fix it back up somehow. They say it doesn't matter if the power plant's waste outlives us by 1,000 years. We'll be gone by then anyhow. And we want that juice right now. Leave the waste for the next ones, our granddaughters and grandsons. But they tell you don't worry, got to nuke it in a hurry, got to power those appliances now. And there are wise men in white hard hats gonna clean it back up somehow. Doesn't matter about the rainforest disappearing all around, cause there's nothing you can do but listen to the crashing sound as it falls. And don't worry, eat your burger in a hurry, gotta cut it down, chop it down now. And there are wise men in gray suit coats gonna put it back up somehow. And they say it doesn't matter if the farmer's topsoil's going, 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 gone. There are wise men in white feed caps figure out how to put it back on. And they say it doesn't matter about the hole in the sky that we're teetering on the brink. And the signs are everywhere, on the land and the sea and the air. Still they tell you don't worry, got to hurry, 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 gotta do it, gotta get it right now. Leave it to the wise men in white lab coats, they will fix it up, mess it up now. I don't wanna doomsay, don't wanna gloomsay, but I'm worried and I'm worried right now about a fragile place called Earth. How we scarce realize her worth. Would we squander her away for a thrill today, for a short-sighted quick fix now? Or will we think ahead somehow about our children's children now? And the very wise men can't leave it to them, got to take it in our own hands now. It takes the wisdom of a cow. I got to think about it, think about it, think about it, think about it, do something about it now.
That was Meg Daly with For Our Children, and then Dean Stevens with Wise Men in White Lab Coats.
While we're speaking about squandering groundwater, Foster's reported earlier this week that Save Our Groundwater will host a special presentation about the study currently investigating the availability of groundwater resources in southeastern New Hampshire at its January 13th meeting. Two researchers from the study, Tom Mack of the U.S. Geological Survey and Lindsay Anderson from the New Hampshire Coastal Program, will give an overview of the project, discuss the groundwater flow model being used for the Seacoast area, and answer questions. According to the U.S. Geological Survey website for the project, the study area for this three-year multidisciplinary project has experienced a 36% increase in population in the past 20 years, creating an estimated 50% increase in the use of groundwater and surface water for drinking, industrial, and other uses. The study is compiling existing data on wells and aquifers, installing and operating a monitoring network, determining water use and water use budgets for participating towns, and estimating the general water availability in each community and modeling the effects of projected future growth on groundwater. The meeting is open to the public and begins at 7 p.m. at the Sugar Shack on Route 4 in Barrington, a half mile west of the Lee Traffic Circle. For more information about Save Our Groundwater, visit www.saveourgroundwater.org. Getting back to our theme of nuclear issues, on July 3, 2003, a judge voided a federal cleanup plan for nuclear waste. The Energy Department's plan for cutting billions of dollars in several years off the bomb waste cleanup at three government nuclear reservations is illegal, a federal judge has ruled, because it would leave some of the wastes in shallow burial sites, despite Congress's prescription that they can only be safely disposed in deep geologic repositories. The radioactive wastes are in tanks, many already rusting, at a reservation in Hanford, Washington, another near Aiken, South Carolina, and a third in Idaho. In a December 9, 2004 story from a Wall Street Journal report, buoyed by the re-election of President Bush, whose administration has pushed to expand nuclear power as part of its national energy plan, the nuclear power industry is laying the groundwork to build new plants in the U.S. for the first time in more than two decades. While opposition to new plants is likely to be fierce, the companies and energy department hope to win approval for construction from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as early as 2009. A story from June 16, 2004 in Reuters, the U.S. Senate backed the Bush administration's plan to study a new generation of low-yield and earth-penetrating nuclear weapons, rejecting concerns that the research could spur an arms race. These new weapons are being designed for potential use against Iran and North Korea, states accused of having weapons of mass destruction. In a 55-42 vote, the Senate defeated an amendment pushed by Democrats to slash $36.6 million to study so-called bunker-busting nuclear weapons that would be used to destroy underground facilities as well as smaller nuclear arms with half the yield of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Senator Edward Kennedy said about this, "The specter of nuclear war looms even larger with the ominous statements of senior officials in the Bush administration that they in fact consider these new weapons more usable." The Massachusetts Democrat said the smaller weapons still would kill or injure hundreds of thousands of people and leave vast areas uninhabitable for years to come. Next, we have a report from Greenpeace about an Australian company that is working on new techniques of uranium enrichment.
There's very little that separates the commercial nuclear industry and the military nuclear industry, and that's one of the problems that nuclear technology has brought us.
What exactly is the technology that's being developed?
It's a method of enriching uranium mostly, but it also applies to other radioisotopes using laser beams, high-powered lasers. You have to enrich natural uranium to about around 5% for it to be functional in a reactor as fuel, but up to around 90% for it to be usable for nuclear weapons. And what they're trying to do is develop new methods of enriching uranium in much smaller plants using less energy and much cheaper to construct.
So besides nuclear weapons, what can the uranium be used for?
Well, the uranium can be used as fuel for reactors, and that's what the company Silex is saying is their main focus. But it's the fear that any technology that makes uranium enrichment cheaper and easier is going to pose real risks to nuclear proliferation that is the greatest concern, and that, you know, this company is saying, well, that will never happen, you know, this technology will never fall into the wrong hands. Well, that would be a first. There's never been a technology that has been able to be prevented from falling into the wrong hands, and, you know, like, whose hands are the wrong hands anyway? No one should be in the business of developing nuclear technology, and in our alliance, the United States, we say that the wrong hands is anyone but, you know, the main big nuclear superpowers, and that's the hypocrisy that is causing us, you know, big problems in the world today, is that countries like the United States want there to be one rule for them and a different rule for everyone else. And unless we have global steps towards disarmament, then you're always going to have countries like North Korea and Iran wanting to develop their own nuclear capacity.
You mentioned a company, that company is obviously Silex. Who exactly is Silex?
Silex is a publicly listed company that was born out of a health company, actually, a company called Sonic Healthcare. Sonic Healthcare, number 25, I think, off the top of my head, in Australia's top 100 companies. They have huge interests in pathology laboratories specifically. So several of the directors of Sonic are also directors of Silex. Silex was set up in the 90s. They obtained a lot of an incredible amount of support from the federal government, including direct funding of somewhere to almost to the tune of $3 million. And the government has even gone so far as to enact bilateral agreements with the United States to allow the transfer of this sensitive nuclear technology, and seems to be turning a blind eye to the company's activities, because, you know, they're not being subjected to the same sort of scrutiny that they should be. For instance, if you can imagine trying to set up a uranium enrichment plant in Brisbane, you would imagine that you'd get a little bit of attention. These guys have done it with virtually no attention at all, and no one checking to see that, you know, what the risks of the operations are, how much radioactive waste they've manufactured, how much radioactive materials they've brought into the country, how they brought it into the country, for instance. You know, we believe that they've flown uranium hexafluoride gas in through Sydney Airport. They've just been allowed to operate completely below the radar, and that's completely unacceptable.
Why do you think there has been so much secrecy around Silex and this uranium enrichment in Australia?
Because it's very sensitive, because the Australian government doesn't want scrutiny of its nuclear program. And, you know, there's one really significant fact here, and that is that the US Department of Energy has a classification system where it determines the level of secrecy that surrounds different nuclear technologies. Now, Silex technology was the first time that the US Department of Energy applied what is known as a restricted data classification to a privately held technology. Now, restricted data usually only applies to information relating to the design, the manufacture, or construction of nuclear weapons, which gives you a pretty clear indication of just how potentially dangerous this technology is.
What impact could this technology, uranium enrichment, have on the environment?
Well, the main thing that we've been trying to find out is how much radioactive waste have they produced. Now, it's not massive amounts, most probably, but we don't know, and we think that we deserve to know, and we think that the company deserves to be held accountable for it, because at the moment they're not telling anyone how much waste they've got or what they plan to do with it. In large scale, in sort of full scale uranium enrichment, the waste product that most people know about, they don't know where it comes from, and that's depleted uranium. The depleted uranium shells and warheads that are used by the US and other militaries are basically waste product for uranium enrichment projects.
Australia has been always against nuclear weapons and technology involving nuclear weapons. Do you think their international standing will be affected by this project?
Yeah, I think that it's extremely hypocritical that the Australian government is supporting the development of this technology, which it has gone to war with Iraq to stop that country from developing, and is now pretty clearly alongside the US threatening Iran with invasion if they don't stop, or at least military strikes if they don't stop their research into uranium enrichment. We clearly have no need for uranium enrichment in this country, and it's hypocritical of the government to be supporting it. And I think that really just shows that the Australian government are taking the same line as many of the other, you know, nuclear superpowers, in that there's one rule for them and one for everyone else. You know, it's important to remember that all of the main nuclear powers agreed, when they signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to permanently dismantle all of their nuclear weapons. Now, none of them have met that obligation, and countries like Australia should be holding those countries to their obligations. But of course, we don't, because we're completely in the pocket of the United States government, and increasingly our military is absolutely interwoven with theirs. And we've got a pro-US government that, and a pro-military government that wants us to stay in this huge multinational military game.
On Thursday, January 6th, the House and Senate held a joint session to certify the electoral votes from the 2004 election. Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs-Jones from Ohio filed a formal challenge to Ohio's 20 electoral votes. A similar complaint was filed in 2001 regarding the Florida vote, but no senator would sign on to the complaint, as is required by law. This time was different, though, as Barbara Boxer, senator from California, joined Representative Tubbs-Jones. This action meant that the House and Senate had to recess for 2 hours and separately debate the issue before voting on the challenge. Since Congress is controlled by Republicans, it didn't seem possible that Bush's victory would be overturned, and when the challenge was voted on, it was not upheld. Ohio's 20 electoral votes were then certified for President Bush. Even though the challenge was defeated, senators and members of Congress spoke to the issue. Senator Boxer said, "We have fought for social justice. We have fought for economic justice. We have fought for environmental justice. We have fought for criminal justice. Now we must add a new fight, the fight for electoral justice. Every citizen of this country who is registered to vote should be guaranteed that their vote matters, that their vote is counted, and that in the voting booth of their community, their vote has as much weight as the vote of any senator, any congressperson, any president, any cabinet member, or any CEO of any Fortune 500 corporation. I am sure that every one of my colleagues, Democratic, Republican, and Independent, agrees with that statement, that in the voting booth, everyone is equal." Not everyone was happy with this challenge. Republican Representative Dreyer said the people questioning the Ohio vote are aiding terrorists, and others complained about bitterness and partisanship by Democrats. Congressman Sam Farr of California made this statement in support of the challenge. "It's hypocritical of the United States to demand that Ukraine hold another presidential election in the face of voting fraud while we turn a blind eye to problems in our own system. It's ridiculous for any supporter of our democratic process to call today's objections foolish or a waste of time. No American should be in doubt about whether or not their vote was accurately counted, and it is right and proper for Congress to take the time to discuss this critical issue." Thousands of people from around the country called their different senators, asking them to support Representative Tubbs-Jones in this challenge. And one would think that it would be easy to follow this story in the press. However, the mainstream media has buried this story. This is why alternative media is so important to our democracy. This is Stanley Longstaff, WSCA LP, Portsmouth, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio, Making Waves.
Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves program. We're going to start off with some announcements. On Sunday, January 9th at 1 p.m., there'll be a potluck peace party in Farmington, New Hampshire. For more information or to RSVP, contact Manny or Pat. The phone number is 603-332-0732. On Saturday, January 22nd, from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., there will be the 10th Annual Changing Maine Gathering for Organizers and Activists, Creating a Maine Social Forum in Augusta, Maine. For more information or to register, call Larry Danzinger at 207-525-7776 or invert at acadia.net. On Wednesday, January 26th at 7 p.m., there'll be a community forum on compassion in a time of strife and suffering. The recent tsunami disaster and the war in Iraq bring up many questions about what our values are individually and as a nation. Listen and share your thoughts on ethics, morality, and spirituality. This event is sponsored by Seacoast Alliance for Democracy and Seacoast Peace Response. This will be occurring at the UU Church. For more information, contact Nancy at 436-7861. On Saturday, January 29th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., be a scribe for peace and justice. New Hampshire Peace Action is sponsoring a write-a-thon in which participants will write letters to elected officials, organizations, and newsletters to express our progressive positions. The write-a-thon is an opportunity to engage in our civic responsibility, enjoy the community of friends, learn more about the issues we care about, and meet like-minded people. We will provide talking points on a host of different issues of critical importance today. The event will be held in Concord. Please contact them at 228-0559 or email amiller AMILLER, at nhpeaceaction.org. On Tuesday, February 1st, at 7 p.m., there'll be an event called U.S. Policy and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty with Dr. Joseph Gerson. He's an author, longtime organizer, and a member of the Steering Committee for Abolition 2000, a global nuclear weapons abolition network. Dr. Gerson shares his wealth of knowledge and understanding with us at the UU Church. And this will be sponsored by SPR, that's Seacoast Peace Response, and New Hampshire Peace Action. For more information, contact Ann Miller again at 228-0559. And a tentatively scheduled event for Wednesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m., we're planning on having a concert by political songwriter and singer Dave Rovics and Rob Johnson. This is a benefit for WSCA LPFM at the UU Church, sponsored by WSCA and Seacoast Peace Response. For more information, contact Amy Antonucci, AMYLA44 at juno.com, 750-7506. Every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m., there is a peace vigil in Market Square in Portsmouth, sponsored by Seacoast Peace Response. The vigil is a presence in opposition to U.S. bombing and warfare and to any further expansion of military retaliation. For further information, contact Doug Bogan at 430-9565 or Macy Morse, macymorse at aol.com. Also every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m., there's a peace vigil in front of the Town Hall on the corner of Water and Front Streets near the bandstand in Exeter. Please bring your signs and hopeful spirits. Contact Donna Schlackman, 772-4934. And on Saturdays, from 11 a.m. to noon, there's a peace vigil on the traffic island at the corner of Central Ave and Washington Street in Dover, sponsored by the War Resisters League of Southeastern New Hampshire. This vigil will take place as long as the U.S. continues to bomb or in any way attacks another country. For further information, contact David Diamond at 749-9159 or ddiam at ttlc.net or Tom Jackson, Coffee Anon, COFFEEANON at yahoo.com. And next we're going to play an excerpt from a talk by Doug Roeke, a veteran and expert on depleted uranium weapons. He made a presentation at the World Uranium Weapons Conference in Hamburg, Germany. And this audio is courtesy of the Taprock Peace Center.
1991, I was given the directive from General Norman G. Schwarzkopf to clean up the depleted uranium mess in the Gulf. There's only three words I can give when I got up there, and that's, oh my God. The casualties were horrible, and I mean the wounds, I mean the crispy critters. The destruction of the weapons and the armor and the vehicles and the buildings was beyond comprehension. And within 48 hours to 72 hours, our team started getting sick. You need to understand, the purpose of war is to kill and destroy. If it moves, if it's human or animal, you kill it. If it doesn't move, you either paint it or you destroy it. There is no ethics, there is no morality. There is no consideration for collective what we call collateral damage. Collateral damage is the death or the destruction of men, women, and children, hospitals, schools, anything else. The purpose of war is to kill and destroy. There is no ethics. There is no morality. In the last 2 years, I have seen the peace movement come together with groups and worlds from all groups and organizations trying to stop a war that was totally planned. You need to understand, the guys you're dealing with, us warriors, don't give a hoot and a holler about ethics and morality. The job is to kill and destroy, and the consequences are totally irrelevant. As Susan said, and Susan will get up here and talk, and Susan lost her husband to this stuff, okay, who was a warrior out of Canada. It's a rape beyond you'll ever imagine. It's a total abandonment beyond anything that you'll ever dream about. 1990, I'd been in the military some 23 years. By the way, I came in the military in 1967. I served 2 years in Vietnam before I even shaved. I retired from the military in the United States Army a month ago. That's over 30 some odd years of service to my nation. I'm a warrior. You need to understand that. Lock, stock, and barrel. I have killed before. If I need to kill again, I will in a heartbeat. I won't even hesitate. But today, some things are flat wrong. And in 1990, when I got sent to the Gulf War specifically to work with nuclear and biological chemical warfare and theater command staff, we knew what Iraq had because we gave it to them. You need to understand that. And we blew it up to just prevent it from coming back on us. It came back on us and we all got sick. I'd never heard of uranium munitions. 23 years after I came into the military, I had never heard of DU munitions. And I got a memorandum in 1990 in December via the U.S. mail. You need to understand. The U.S. mail in the United States, mail gets through no matter what the weather is. But in the military, there's no, you can't even guarantee if you're going to get food, if you're going to get blood, or you're going to get bullets when you need them. You don't know. I get a memorandum from the Pentagon, Colonel Charles Day, saying you better start thinking about uranium munitions, the health and environmental effects. And I go, what are those things? Well, lo and behold, did I have no idea that in March of 1991, after the completion of the ground war, General Schwarzkopf and his chief of staff would issue an order telling me to clean up the DU mess. Well, I'm going to finish the job, but I guarantee you, boy, ladies and gentlemen, they're not happy. And when you start dealing with this stuff, telling the truth about what we affects, the retaliation is massive. You talk about abandonment and rape, you don't even have an idea of what's going on. Now, uranium munitions are by definition, and Karen Parker from the United Nations, she's here to talk about the legal things, are already illegal weapons. They've always been illegal weapons. So when we talk about banning DU, we need to get a moratorium. We need to get people held accountable for what they've done. Because it's illegal. It's been illegal from day one to take and spread solid radioactive waste that from the United States and from England and Australia all over another nation. It's always been illegal. And the weapons are illegal because they're totally indiscriminate. They last forever. They go outside the battlefield, and they affect the children. If you haven't seen the pictures, the children in the Gulf War, talk to the doctors that are here in the audience taking care of them, or talk to any of the doctors that are taking care of any of us. You better get another picture. Now, uranium rounds, what are they? The depleted uranium round that we used in Gulf War I, we had primarily three different rounds. We had the tank round, which is 120 millimeter. Each individual round is a giant rod, approximately 3/4 of an inch in diameter. Okay? That's about 1.5 centimeters. 18 inches long. That's about 8 centimeters. And each individual round is over 4,700 grams of solid uranium, contaminated with plutonium, neptunium, americium, and uranium-236. We fired over 15,000 of those. Then we had the round fired by the A-10. That A-10 fires a round that's 300 grams each at 4,000 rounds per minute. There wasn't nothing loaded out of any of these things except for uranium munitions. And then we had the cluster bombs, the Petum and the Atom. Cluster bombs that you throw there and everybody steps on later and blow up in your face. Well, it's not where they blow up, but they take you off at the waist down and totally mess up your body really good. Ask the spouses that tried to have relations when their husbands came back and there's nothing left from the waist down, but yet they're there. Now, uranium rounds when the impact. The way it works is that uranium round gets fired out of the gun. The thing is on fire the minute it leaves the gun. It is burning the minute it leaves the gun. And it's flying downrange at over 3,000 meters per second. Unbelievable velocities. And the uranium is very soft and very pyrophoric, and that's why it's burning. It's pyrophoric. And on impact, about 40% of this thing breaks up, okay, and create what we call shrapnel or spalling. Now, that spalling goes down to a size as small as 0.1 micron. That's smaller than the inner diameter of a red blood cell. And you got this stuff scattered all over. And about 40% of that round stays intact, and it passes through the vehicle and is deposited. Now, the radioactivity given off this stuff, you can read the science books all day long you want to. You can read technical journals. Let me tell you, it's a lot different when you're working with it for real, because this stuff is contaminated with everything. So we're seeing at radiation through over 300 millirems per hour, beta and gamma, and thousands upon thousands of counts per minute alpha. I'm not talking about, you know, a few. We're talking about 15,000 to a million counts per minute. Now you start adding that all up, the cumulative dose rate, you got a real problem. This stuff is not innocuous. Now the U.S. military has known it since 1943. The leaders have known it since 1940. They know that there is no respiratory skin protection, and they know there is no medical care. How many of you guys like to go to war and not get a bullet in your butt from charging a machine gun nest, but find out that you're sick and dying because you're exposed to all the health and environmental effects of war? And you don't know when you're going to die, and you don't know what's happened, and you can't swim anymore, and you can't run anymore. You've got to understand, these warriors all here up in these panels, we can run all day long, and as we say in the United States, leap tall buildings in a single bound. Hell, we got a problem running, walking across the block now, or going up the stairs. War is a toxic wasteland. Now, when that uranium round hits, you get a fine dust that's spread all over the place, and it gets resuspended forever. Horst just came back from over there in Basra, okay, and he said the contamination is still extensive. Yeah, well, it would be for eternity. The stuff, when it's put on the ground, it gets resuspended. You open up a struck vehicle, it's resuspended. You breathe it in, you inhale it in, you absorb it in through your skin, and you get sick. Respiratory problems, the rashes. These are chemical toxicity problems and fine particulate problems. The cancers on our team started within 9 months. Surprise! Everybody says it takes a long time to get cancer. No, it doesn't, because you're up to a toxic wasteland of radioactive heavy metal waste plus all the other contaminants of war, i.e. when you blow up a building, you blow up a vehicle, heavy metals, you got inorganic, you got organic compounds, you got biological waste parts of bodies, and y'all get sick. Uranium rounds impact, it ain't just a solid chunk of uranium, i.e. we got uranium here and we got an apple or an orange over here. No, you got a mixed waste of junk. Now right off the bat, when I got the directive to do this, I got an order to cover it up, the famous Los Alamos Memorandum. You need to understand. They knew it's illegal. They knew the health and environmental effects, and they ordered us to cover it up. Well, I'll be darned if I'm ever going to do that for them. I won't do it. Now, I also got a memorandum that said this stuff is not only a health threat, it's a serious health threat. This came also right down through the Army chain of command. They knew. Well, heck, any fourth grader, my high school biology, chemistry, and physics students, know it. My eighth grade science students know it. Anybody would. They don't care. You've got to understand the purpose of war is to kill and destroy. Uranium munitions are already illegal. To spend money on trying to get a treaty or a ban, you're wasting your money and your time and your effort. And you're only going to get frustrated. You need to understand reality. The reality also comes down from all these exposures and everything. Out of Gulf War I now, as of May of 2002, and the data is a lot higher now, over 221,000 of us that served in the Gulf War are now permanently disabled. You got three of us up here right now, two of us from the United States and one from Australia. War is death and illness. And the death count, the official death count for the VA is over 10,000, but it's actually over 18,000. Nobody tells you that's the casualty count from Gulf War I. Well, it goes on and on and on. We put all our reports together. We started reporting the health and environmental effects. I directed medical care immediately for all those that were exposed, not only U.S. and Canadian and Australian. We couldn't get it. Down at the end there is Dennis Kine, U.S. Army medic, frontline combat medic. He tried to give these kids frontline medical care immediately and get it set up. They ain't got it to this day. Ever think about what that's like to know you're a medic charged with saving lives and you can't save lives? And after you send them back, your own government and all the governments of the world ignore it, don't provide medical care to the warriors, much less all of the non-combatants. That's the women and the children. 1993, we're putting all our reports together. A written directive came down from the Army directing the Army and the VA to leave the DU shrapnel and that stuff into the warriors, in the bodies of the soldiers. I thought Mengele was dead. No, he works at the Pentagon. A direct order. And Jerry Wheat, Sergeant Jerry Wheat, you'll see him in the videos. Up in 1999, they just removed the shrapnel out of his body. The DU was embedded in the shrapnel, in the tumor. And the guy that wrote this directive said, Jerry and Doug, you got to prove that the tumor surrounding the DU shrapnel that we just removed from your body was caused by the DU shrapnel in your body.
That was Doug Rocky speaking at a conference in Hamburg, Germany, about the world's uranium weapons. The rest of that program can be downloaded from the Trap Rock Peace Center, www.traprockpeace.org/audio/doug_rokke.mp3.
For the last portion of our show, we're going to hear Brian Gregg interview Guy Chichester. Guy is a local resident and a longtime activist. He was very involved in the Clamshell Alliance and efforts to stop construction of Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant.